Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Patty Gentry, who was a chef and is now a farmer. She actually started a farm out on the East End called Early Girl Farm. And she'll be coming on in a little bit, and I'll tell you more about her when she does. But first, I want to go over some things that are going on in the news and ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first off, we all know the coronavirus is continuing to wreak havoc on our usual normal lives. And yet, I think many people are actually, in a funny way, enjoying the silver lining that is coming from this, the opportunity to slow down, to maybe step back and reevaluate some of the things that they're doing in their lives and the ways that they go on with their lives, and maybe taking a little extra time to reorganize and refocus their direction towards something that might be more fulfilling for them. So I do know a few people that have gotten the virus, and knock on wood, they are doing just fine. You know, as much as we can, keeping our immune system strong is really, I think, the best defense we have against this virus. There's a good chance that most of us are going to get it, but how it impacts us really can be different. And, of course, people have pre-existing conditions, and those are real. But we still have lots of things in our little toolbox that we can take, such as, you know, vitamin C and echinacea and golden seal and elderberry and warming foods, ginger, garlic, all these things that we know really build up our immune system. We have those as tools and medicinal remedies to use to keep ourselves strong and try to prevent the virus from taking over in our bodies. So I put on a link last week to order some of that echinacea and golden seal tincture that I use all the time. That's called ZAND, Z-A-N-D formula. They have a formula that actually has elderberry in it. That's really great. So I highly recommend that. Making lots of miso soup, really, with a lot of ginger and garlic and wakame seaweed, and just eating that up and loving it and just feeling like it's revitalizing me as I eat it. So those are all things that we can do. One of the things that I want to share with you, while we are all focused on the coronavirus, our government continues to give the green light to polluters and to big corporations who are seeing this as an opportunity to move ahead with their agendas and be forgiven by not following the current guidelines that they normally have to fall under. So the Environmental Protection Agency has announced a freeze on enforcing environmental regulations due to the virus. And this is, you know, just giving a green light to so many agricultural corporations to continue to pollute and be able to use that the coronavirus as an excuse as to why they were not able to meet the guidelines that are actually a law. So that's pretty upsetting. National Grid has continued to push through trying to build their pipelines. They actually were saying that it was essential construction. As you know, in New York State, Governor Cuomo has prevented any construction from taking place unless it is infrastructure, essential construction for the infrastructure of our society. And National Grid was trying to say that these pipelines were part of the infrastructure. And luckily, due to lots of perseverance on the part of Brooklyn neighbors and grassroots movements like Sane Energy and Food and Water Watch, they got National Grid to stop the continuation of building the pipeline for now. Gives us a little bit more time to keep trying to close it down altogether. The Williams pipeline, as you know, they're still trying to build that, even though it's been denied a few times. They still are trying to present it as a way to meet all the energy needs that they need. And nowhere in their proposals are they talking about solar or wind. It's just inexcusable with the new environmental law that was passed this past spring. We have to meet certain guidelines and deadlines that we have set up, and wind and solar can help us get there. And these pipelines and the liquid gas stations that they want to put out in the water are just not the way to do it. So we need to keep pushing forward. I do have some links on my website under Take Action where you can sign petitions and letters to your Congress people and let your voice be heard. We really need to galvanize all these grassroots movements together and work together to make our voices louder than the money that these corporations have. And that's hard because they have a lot of money. So we really, really need to work together for that. So I want to share with all of you my recipe this week, which is a gluten-free vegan chocolate chip pecan lace cookies. Now, I know I've been talking about staying healthy and keeping our immune system strong, and I have to say sugar is not the way to do it. But if you are craving sugar and you do need to have a fix, you do want to do it with something that you created yourself. So these gluten-free vegan chocolate chip cookies really do the trick. So what you need is 1 cup of coconut oil, 1 cup of organic brown sugar, 1 cup of organic white sugar, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon ground flaxseed, 1 tablespoon vanilla, 1/2 cup of organic applesauce, 2 cups of gluten-free vegan flour mix, 1 cup of organic gluten-free oats, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1 10-ounce bag of vegan chocolate chips, and 1 cup of pecans, roughly chopped. And you're going to start by pulsing and creaming the coconut oil, the brown sugar, and white sugar together in a food processor for about 5 minutes. Then in a separate bowl, you're going to mix the flax seeds with 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar and let that sit for about 5 minutes. Then you're going to add the applesauce and the vanilla to the flax seeds and then add that mixture into the food processor with the coconut oil and the sugars and pulse that together. In a separate bowl, mix the dry ingredients together. Add the wet mixture from the food processor to the dry ingredients and mix that well. When thoroughly mixed, add the chocolate chips and the pecans. Mix that up, and then you're going to drop spoonfuls of cookie dough onto the cookie sheet that's lined with parchment paper, and you're going to bake it for 7 to 8 minutes until it's crispy. And if your oven's like mine, the back is hotter than the front, so halfway through you're going to turn the pan around so that it cooks evenly. And then the cookies, you should know, these really spread out a lot. So when you place them on the cookie sheet, allow a lot of space between them. And they become very thin and lacy, and they get very crispy. And let them cool before transferring onto a platter. And that's it. I hope you all enjoy them. They're really delicious. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, my guest this week is Patty Gentry. And as I said before, I met Patty last year when I attended the Food Lab Conference out at the East End Food Institute. And there they actually showed a documentary film that they made about her called The Soul of a Farmer, which is about her and her farm. And before being a farmer, Patty was a cook, and she had a rich and rewarding experience working under the tutelage of Anne Rosenzweig of Acadia and the Lobster Club, which are both in New York City, and also Lydia Shire of Biba in Boston. She partnered with Gary and Isabel McKern to open the Hampton Chutney Company in Soho, New York, and has had the good fortune to work with Ben Schneider and Sohoo Kim at the Good Fork in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And before trading in her apron for a hoe 6 years ago, she was lucky enough to spend 4 years in the kitchen at the Ross School in East Hampton. And Patty started her farm, Early Girl Farm, so that she could bring highly diversified, lovingly raised produce to hardworking chefs in New York and out on the East End,
And now this year she's actually starting a CSA.
Patty, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for taking time from your busy day to
my
join
pleasure.
Us here. So maybe you could just share a little bit of your history. I know you worked in the restaurant business for about 25 years before you got into farming.
Yes.
What inspired you to make the switch?
Well, I was living in Brooklyn at the time in Park Slope, and I was a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op. And when I was there, I was eating the most delicious locally sourced foods, vegetables and fruits, artisanal cheeses, and, you know, humanely raised meats. And I felt so much better. And so as a chef, I really wanted to share what I was eating myself at home with the public. And I thought, you know, at the time, farm-to-table movement isn't as strong as it is now. And so I made the decision that I wanted to see what went into growing organic food. At the time, like I said, it wasn't as widely practiced as it is now. Now, better restaurants are almost expected to source very conscientiously. But back then, you know, it was cost prohibitive. And
when you say back then, how far back are you going?
10 years.
Uh-huh.
So 10 years ago, you know, it was still a thing that was like, well, I wondered, why is it more costly to buy these artisanally raised vegetables and delicious dairy products and all that? And I was very curious what went into growing food. So I sold my shares. I was a partner in a little restaurant in Soho at the time, and I sold my shares back to my business partners. And I went home and I Googled, I'm selling my shares to my business partners. I'm thinking about growing organic vegetables. You know, where should I go? What should I do? I like put that all in the search bar. And up came a couple of recommendations. And one of them was a place out in East Hampton called Eco Farm, which is still there, was hiring interns to work on the farm in the summertime. And so I went. I rented a little tool shed that someone was calling a cottage in the back of their house.
Uh-huh.
And I worked at Eco Farm underneath a managing farmer named Paul Hamilton, who was such an amazing teacher. And after my internship at the end of the summer, he gave me an Earthway seeding machine. And he said to me, "You're going to be a farmer one day." And I thought, wow, that's such a beautiful thought. I wanted it to be true, but I didn't really see it clearly at that time. And but he was right. So, you know, that was the beginning of my journey into farming, was that internship at Eco Farm, and it all kind of unfolded from there.
Uh-huh. I have to ask you, what is an Earthway seeding machine?
An Earthway seeding machine is it's a very primitive hand-pushed seeder. And so there's different plates. You can see lettuce or peas or beans. And you set the depth. It plants the seeds at the proper depth. And there's a little chain that goes behind the furrow maker. And it covers up the seed furrow with dirt. And
yeah.
I still use it, the one that he gave me 10
mm-hmm.
years ago.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that I did it, you know, that I got into farming. It's been a very rewarding experience, certainly.
Uh-huh. I was going to ask you if you would give advice to anyone who wanted to get into farming, what would it be? And I was going to guess that you'd say, don't do it. But what would it be?
No, actually, absolutely do it. And for myself, I think planning is really important. I think it's important to not bite off more than you can chew. Starting small is the best thing. You want to be able to take very good care of any of the plants that you commit to the soil. And, you know, I think when I say planning, I mean decide what you want to plant. Do you want to grow flowers? Do you want to grow leafy greens? Do you want to find something to kind of specialize in? Because when you look at the spectrum of all the things you can plant, it can be very overwhelming. And in the beginning, that's what I did. I planted everything. I planted luffa. I had no idea that you could grow it. I thought it came from the ocean. It's actually in the cucumber family.
Really?
It's amazing. I planted something called a lychee tomato that I really was expecting to be like a juicy lychee hanging from the vine. It wasn't. It was like this, it was a sprawling thorn-filled vine that would like rip the shirt off my back every time I walked past it. But I thought like there would be a huge market for lychee tomatoes because it just sounded so good. And so, you know, I learned the hard way by growing crops that weren't really delicious. I didn't have a market for them. And so a couple of years ago, I discovered a book by this guy named Ben Hartman called The Lean Farm. And he's all about really making wise choices for yourself. So really focusing your energy, deciding the space that you want to plant in, how long the beds will be, how far apart you're going to plant your plants, and then you'll know how many plants you need to fill the space so you're not over-ordering seeds or overproducing seedlings. So I really did learn the hard way. When I first started, I started so many seedlings, I just didn't have a plan. I had to start a plant adoption agency where people would come and I'd say, please adopt these plants. I have so many. I would give them away. And of course, like that's time and money. And so I went the long way around to get to where I am now, which is an Excel sheet that has the beds on it, the planting schedule for the season, what I'm going to plant, when I'm going to plant it, exactly. I know how many seeds I need to the ounce now, but it took me a very long time to get here. So I would say anyone who wants to get into farming, it can be profitable and it's always enjoyable, but to really make a good plan for yourself, a business plan. And there's a lot of ways, resources out there to help you do that. Mm-hmm. So that's my suggestion. Plan.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You know, I've been doing it for a long time and I still don't have that down. You know, it's not my livelihood and I'm doing all these other things. I just, you know, kind of like see what I have left from last year and then I see what I'm missing and I order it, but I don't have that plan down. It sounds really exciting. I'm going to have to look into that book.
Yes, and, you know, even for me, I say, okay, well, potatoes aren't profitable for me. It's because I'm very small, I'm 2 acres, and greens are more profitable, and they take much less time to grow than a potato, which takes months. But still, when I'm at the jumping off point of, like, never planting potatoes, I go, but then how could you not have a Yukon gem? How could you not, you know,
right.
A purple Viking? Oh, my God, I'd be lost without these things. So I always end up, you know, impulse buying at the last minute because everything is so thrilling to grow.
Right.
So, you know, but from a business perspective, when you're home, do whatever you want. It's so much fun, and even at the farm. But it is wise to conserve your efforts. Certainly. So,
yeah, absolutely. So in addition to Ed Hartman, what other books or teachers or influencers would you recommend people looking into?
So for small scale farming, there's Ben Hartman and there is Connor Crickmore. He has a place called Never Sink Farm in upstate New York, and he's a master of high production in a very small area. And he teaches online. You can take master classes and learn from him how to max out a very small space. You could use it. You could apply his concepts to a home garden. He's amazing. So there's Ben Hartman, Lean Farm. There's Connor Crickmore from Never Sink Farm. There's a guy from Canada. Oh no, now I'm spacing on his name. I'll think of it,
okay.
but he does sprouting, and he farms people's front yards. He turns
I know who you mean. Yeah, I actually interviewed him.
Yes.
A long time ago. Yep.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He's amazing. And for soil knowledge and nutrition knowledge, there's the Bionutrient Food Association, which is run by a man named Dan Kitteridge, which is so incredible because they teach you how to build healthy soil. And so all healthy plants start with healthy soil. And when I first started farming, I relied on the man who I bought my soil amendments from to guide me in reading the soil tests. I didn't know how to read a soil test. So I didn't know how much calcium I needed, how much manganese or zinc I needed. I would rely on him, and he's a lovely man. But after I met Dan Kitteridge and went to the Bionutrient Food Association, they empowered me. I now know how to read a soil test.
Right.
And it's thrilling to know to the ounce how much boron you need or how much selenium. I mean, things I never would have thought of. And it's so amazing because everything that a human being would need and that we take a multivitamin for, we can really get through eating healthy food that comes from soil that's balanced.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bionutrient Food Association, it really educates you on every level from the soil up. And so that's just been an incredible resource for me. And through the Bionutrient Food Association, I learned about all the great writers and soil scientists of Charles Walters, who started Acres Magazine, and William Albrecht, a soil scientist from, I believe, the 1950s. It could have been even earlier than that. Carrie Reams, all of these incredible people that little by little I read their books and I learn a bit more. And I always say, if you know nothing and you throw a handful of seeds in the ground, you usually get something. But the more you know, the better yield you get, the longer your plants live. And so it's thrilling, you know.
Yeah.
There's so many facets of plant health, and they're all important, and they're all sciences that you devote yourself to studying your whole life. Biodynamics or paramagnetism or just soil balancing, all of these things. So I love it for that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I remember when I interviewed Dan Kitteridge on my show, he was talking about this metric, this meter that he was inventing, and I know he's gotten closer. I don't know if it's actually come out yet, where you can actually, you know, put it into a cucumber and it will tell you.
Yes,
they
have it. They have it.
Do?
It's a laser. It's something that's like a refractometer. So a refractometer reads the amount of sugar that a plant is producing. And so if a plant is producing, say, 12% sugar, it's indicative that it's also producing proteins and fats and that it has more nutrients available for people that are eating it. It's called BRIX, B-R-I-X. That's the reading of sugar from a plant. And so it's normally, you know, 10 to 12% is a very healthy plant. And so this machine that Dan has created gives the consumer the power to pick the healthiest vegetables from the shelves of the supermarket. And, you know, the refractometer I use at the farm, I read plant sap, and it's brutal. You have to have nerves of steel to use it because you can't tell by looking at a plant if it's healthy or not. And so every year I get it out and I get ready to, like, go have a stiff drink afterwards because I do all this work to balance the soil and, you know, starting from seedlings, mixing the soil, mixing with nutrients and microbes and nutrients in the field and all mulching and irrigation. And then I test the plant and let's say 10% or 12% sugar is good quality. Sometimes mine is 4 or 6. And I like using it because it really keeps me on my toes, and it helps me to just continue to want to grow the healthiest food possible. And how do I get there? What's missing? So, yeah, this thing that Dan Kitteridge has developed really puts that power in the hands of the consumer to make more educated choices when they're shopping at the store. So,
I always say, I mean, all broccolis are not created equal. You know, it's all about the soil, the same way a parent, you know, a mother has a baby, and, you know, how healthy it is depends on how healthy she was while she, you know, the baby was growing inside of her. So,
oh, definitely.
It really makes a difference. And that's the whole dynamic, you know, when we're talking about the hydroponics and it has no soil and, you know, and nobody will tell you what they're even putting in the water. It's all proprietary information. So, you know, I'm very fascinated and very supportive of organic farmers, you know, and not considering hydroponics in the same level of quality. It might not have pesticides and herbicides, but it's not organic, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, one of the nice things about knowing your farmer is there's that transparency there. And so if you knew a hydroponic farmer, you could just say, what are you putting in the water? You know, and maybe it is getting what it needs. I don't know. But all I know is that, like, one of the nice things about the chefs that use me or the CSA customers that come here is I'm constantly talking about what I'm doing to the soil, what I'm putting in it, how I'm taking care of the vegetables. And I know that a lot of farmers on Long Island are doing the same thing that I am. And so that's one of the benefits of supporting local agriculture is that you really know what you're eating. You have an opportunity to understand how your food was grown and how, and it, I think that's a wonderful thing. And we're very lucky on Long Island because there's so many resources to become a part of a farm as a CSA or shop at a farm stand. And, you know, it's great because
yeah,
you should
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. And the community that comes from it is also just so nice to, you know, be a part of and be supportive with.
Definitely.
You know, since I joined the NOFA board and have gotten to know so many more of the Long Island farmers, it's really a wonderful community, and I'm, you know, excited to be working with them. And unfortunately, we had to cancel our CSA fair that was supposed to happen last weekend. But I'm so glad you're doing a CSA. What made you decide to branch out and is this your first year with the CSA?
It's my second year with the CSA. I started the business to serve restaurants primarily because I was a cook for so long. And I wanted to, like, bring the diversity of a small farm right to the kitchen door because chefs work hard and they don't have time always to go to the farmer's market and see what's available. So I started the business to serve them, and my landlady at the farm where I'm currently leasing land for my business, raises bees for honey and chickens for eggs, and she had an egg and honey CSA. And people were saying, how do we get Patty's vegetables? And I'd never done a CSA, and I was nervous to do a CSA because I've never been paid up front for something that I haven't produced. Serving restaurants where you bring the food and bill them, and they pay you later. And so to have the stress of, like, people investing in me was something that I was really nervous to do. So I started really small with just 35 members last year, and it was the most rewarding experience. It was so joyful. People come down to the farm on Saturday. The farm's open to all the CSA members, and we have You Pick Herbs, and this year we're doing You Pick Flowers. And people were in the greenhouses cutting basil, in the raised beds cutting herbs, and just being here at the farm. You have to walk through the middle of the fields to get to the CSA pickup. So, and now, like, I love growing for chefs, and I know the people that I grow for, and I always picture them as I'm planting, and it enriches my experience. And now I know these 35 families, and it just adds so much depth to my work that I'm caring for these people, and that they invest in me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it's the greatest thing, the CSA that I've done. I love it. And so this year we expanded and I have 65 members this year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been amazing, especially during this time with this virus going around. I have some early spring crops that I usually deliver to restaurants, and now I've been delivering them to people in their homes. And it's just such a wonderful feeling because the vegetables are so appreciated and they bring comfort, they bring diversity to people's weeks, like waiting to see what they get from the farm.
Right.
And it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. So
you started your CSA already, or you still have vegetables that have wintered over, or
I it starts officially May 23rd. But I do have these greenhouses, so I have some early spring crops. I have salad turnips and radishes and greens and green garlic. And so, like I said, normally I would just sell these early crops to restaurants, but the restaurants are unfortunately temporarily closed. And so, and a lot of people are out
at
in
home
this area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Right.
I started a little online ordering system for CSA members. They can order. So this week I'm doing my greens and oysters from a CSA member that owns Great Gun Oyster Company. Paul McCormick is a CSA member. So I'm delivering his oysters and my greens to people's houses this week.
Oh, wonderful. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's thrilling. It's.
Yeah,
I feel so supported. I feel like, you know, if anything ever went wrong, I could just grow food for this cluster of people.
Right.
And that we have that. We have each other and we have food that we need and everything's going to be okay. You know,
right. Uh-huh.
That's how it feels, especially during this stressful time, you know?
Yep. Absolutely. Growing your own food is so empowering. You have, you know, just like taking care of your own health. I mean, you have control and it is absolutely empowering, and you know, it's one of the reasons I love growing food. You know, I use it very often for cooking classes and events and also to share with friends, but mostly it also feeds my family, and it's just it's very empowering. It's really
oh, definitely cool. I told my CSA members, I read that a lot of people are starting little victory gardens. And,
yeah, we're trying to call them climate gardens.
Yes, climate gardens, exactly. And
uh-huh.
And I read in the New York Times that little chicks are selling out because people are at home and they want a healthy diversion, so they're keeping chickens for eggs and thinking about starting gardens. So I told the CSA members, if anyone needs help, like with gardening advice, I know a lot of local places that sell seeds and amendments and potting soil mix, whatever it is, to help people grow their own food, because it's our birthright as human beings to be able to do it. And it's not hard and it's so fulfilling. So, you know, I'm happy to hear that there's a resurgence of the backyard garden, because my grandparents had one.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be such a great thing if every backyard had a little something growing in it. So maybe this is a trend towards that.
Well, that's like the silver linings I was talking about at the beginning of the show, you know, that there's these glimpses of hope and transformation that's coming from this. You know, our environment's cleaner than ever. You know, they talk about blue sky in China. I know where I live, I have so many less planes going over my house. I am so happy.
Yes.
You know, every 5 minutes I'd have a plane going over my house, and not now.
You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network.
And if you're just joining me today, my guest is Patty Gentry from Early Girl Farm, and we're talking about growing vegetables and the resurgence of home backyard gardens or
yes.
Front yard gardens, whatever it may be. So let's talk about soil. So what
yes.
is it that fascinates you so much about it, and how have you found, you know, really learning all the intricacies about it as you
explore? The soil's alive, and it's like this huge machine that's has a lot of different moving parts, and they're all very important. And so you have to think about the soil life. Like, I just saw this movie called Fantastic Fungi.
Oh, I loved it. Wasn't that great?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And
everyone out there, if you haven't seen it, see it.
It's incredible. And it talks about, like, how underneath our feet is, like, basically the internet of communication that is the mycorrhizal fungi that are the microorganisms, little bitty mushrooms that digest the soil and work in a symbiotic relationship with plants so that they may uptake the minerals in the soil. And so when I think about the soil, I think about it needs to have minerals available. And one thing that was very interesting to me when I started farming is you look at a bag of fertilizer and you see nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, NPK. Those are the three numbers you see on the outside of the bag. And what it doesn't normally mention is calcium, how important calcium is. And so, I didn't know that. That was something that I learned. And it's just so fascinating to me because just like our own bodies, I learned that 65% of a plant's diet has to be calcium because that's what it uses to build its quote-unquote bones. It builds cell walls. It builds its body with calcium just like we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was fascinating to me. And as I said earlier, I learned about molybdenum. Like, I didn't even know how to say that. And I was in Dan Kitteridge's class, and he went, started talking about molybdenum and then went, what? And that's exactly what I was thinking. Like, what? What is molybdenum? And it's a tiny element. I think it's a positively charged ion. But without a trace of molybdenum, the rest of the machine doesn't work as effectively as it could. And also I learned that that little element has the capability of fixing nitrogen from the air into the soil when it's in balance with everything else. So I learned a lot. And what I learned about the soil, like I said, is it's just like our body. Everything you would think about, like we take a probiotic. Why? To build our gut flora. Why? To help us digest nutrients. And the soil is the same. It has to have the nutrients there, and it needs to have the life to digest those nutrients and make them available to the plants. So we add minerals, and then we add microbes. And, and also the soil has the ability to build its own microbial populations. But we inoculate seeds, we inoculate the water that we water plants in with to encourage the growth of these beneficial microorganisms. And water. I just learned recently that, the number one thing to consider when you're planting a plant is, can you bring it adequate water? And I learned that when a plant goes dry, it's like a car running out of oil. Or like your mouth running out of saliva. It everything comes to a grinding halt. And then the plant is vulnerable to disease and bug infiltration because its immunities are weak. And it takes a very long time for all those systems to get back up and running again. So it's just amazing, just this balancing act of the soil, and I'm still learning it. It's fascinating. So
yeah. Now I forget where I learned this, but I thought if a tree, at least like a fruit tree, goes through a big drought, like there's not a lot of water, that it actually produces more fruit the following year, because from the drought it has to produce, in order to survive, it has to work harder, and so it actually pushes out more fruit the following year. Have you heard that?
No, I did not know that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, nature's amazing. So when a plant's under stress, it does something called bolting, which means it goes to flower, and from the flower comes the seed. And so, for example, a year or two ago, I planted a sprouting broccoli way too early. It was a warm spring day. You know how you have those days in March and April where you're like, yay, spring is here, and you start planting in your garden, and then suddenly the weather changes and you get like a 28-degree night.
Mm-hmm.
And these plants, they didn't like it. And so I should have had an enormous plant that was like 2 feet in diameter that was producing, you know, several pounds of broccoli sprouts from each plant. Instead, I had a teeny weeny little plant that sent up a sprout and went to flower immediately. And it's like built inside of them when they're stressed out to proliferate, to save themselves and like go right to seed. So it's amazing what plants do under stress, how they're built to survive, you know?
Yeah. All of it's amazing. I mean, when you just see a little seed and you think that like, oh my God, I'm going to eat the vegetable, the fruit that comes from this little seed all summer long.
It's incredible.
It is. Magical. Right.
And I often think like, I'm so fascinated that there's a tiny little, you know, broccoli rob seed and how big that plant is, or a tomato seed. But think of, like I often say to people that are working with me, human seeds are microscopic and we can live for 100 years. So it is, it's a miracle of life. And that's a privilege of working at a farm or in a garden, is you're surrounded by the reminder of just how amazing it is to be here and to experience the beauty of nature, you know?
Mm-hmm. How far out is your farm? It's not all the way out on the East End, right?
No, it's in Brookhaven.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so not that far out at all.
And were you delivering yourself to New York City, or you had someone do it for you?
I used to. Now I have a driver who delivers, but I actually enjoy delivering because the chefs, they celebrate farmers, which is the most beautiful feeling. And so my partner and I would drive in after a long day of work and deliver the produce, and every restaurant we went to would cook for us. So it was an incredible feeling to be filthy dirty in a pickup truck and eating, like, you know, dark chocolate mousse with extra virgin olive oil and sea salt.
In the truck, or did they let you inside?
Oh, they wanted us to stay, but we would never get home.
Right.
So we just took everything to go. But oh my God, those are the riches of this business, and is just to eat delicious food. It's amazing. And once you start to have it, you never want to go back.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Now, do you miss being in the kitchen?
I don't, not because I didn't love it, but because I'm so fascinated by farming that I'm just engaged in what I do, and I'm not thinking, I wish I was in the kitchen. I cook every night at home, and now I cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Soon I won't be able to do every single meal, but, you know, so I cook constantly.
Right.
So I actually left the business when I finally got good at it. It took me years to become a good line cook. You have to be so organized to work a saute position or a grill position or any position in the kitchen. And similarly to farming, I was all enthusiasm and zero experience. So it took me like a very long time to become more of an asset than a liability as a line cook. And it's fun. Like, you practice, it's like playing an instrument. It's so awkward at first, but when you practice, you get good at it. And then it's thrilling to get busy on a Saturday night at a great restaurant, and you're working the line cooking.
It's a dance, right? It's so much fun. Yeah.
Oh my God, it can be, or it can be torture if you are not organized. And that was my case. I'd be running around. The chef would say, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Where are my tongs?" She's like, "They're in your back pocket." So it took a lot of practice, but I don't miss it in that way. But I loved it while I did it. Now I get to see people that I worked with in the kitchens where I actually worked for them or with them, and now I deliver them vegetables. Uh-huh. So it's a beautiful feeling to have cultivated those relationships and to keep them going but in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what varieties do you like to grow? I know you said you do greens more than potatoes, and I'm right there with you for that. Also, I'd rather eat greens than potatoes mostly, although I do love potatoes.
Me too.
What else do you love to grow that's a little different? I think you gave up on the lychee tomatoes, right?
I gave up on the lychee tomatoes, but this year I have a very interesting tomatillo called the Queen of Malenka, which I got from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, which I can shop for my seeds there because I'm so small scale. They don't have, like, they don't sell things normally by the pound or the quarter pound, but because, like I said, I'm so small, I can get my seeds from there. And so I get pretty much all my sweet peppers, hot peppers, and eggplants and heirloom tomatoes from Baker Creek. And mm-hmm. one of the things I'm really excited about is this Queen of Malenka tomatillo, which looks like a ripe mango coming out of the tomatillo skin. It's the most beautiful thing. So, of course, I don't know how this thing is going to taste, but I'm thinking it's going to taste like the mango that it looks like, with fresh cilantro and a squeeze of lime juice. I mean, how good would that be on a piece of broiled fish, you know? So that, and this year I'm growing a lot of different flowers, which I'm really excited about, for the CSA members. So when they come in, they can cut whatever they want. I have a lot of a culture called cut and come again. So you plant it once and you cut the flowers and they keep producing. So Cosmos is one of those flowers that I seeded just today, actually. And I seeded one called, I think it's called Black Beauty. It's a chocolate Cosmos. Oh, it's called Black Magic Cosmos. And apparently it smells like chocolate. And I got that also from Baker Creek. Mm-hmm. And last year I discovered something called Agastache or Hummingbird Mint. Oh, my God. It is like the most beautiful spray of flowers that a hummingbird would like, because there's those thin trumpet-like flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants were like 4 to 5 feet tall. And it smells like a very floral mint. You can use them for tea. You can use them in cooking. But I just like to put them in a vase or even just walk past them and, like, brush my hand against them. So this year I have three varieties of Agastache: licorice one, a rose-colored one, and an orange one. So those are some of the things. And, of course,
did you also get those from Baker Creek?
Those are all Baker Creek. Yeah, mm-hmm. but I get some of my eggplant varieties from a seed company called Kitazawa, which specializes in Asian vegetables. And the woman who owns the company is bringing back Korean heirlooms. And I bought shiso from her, shiso seed. And the shiso seed came with, like, in the most beautiful, like, almost looked like a handmade paper envelope with a Korean stamp on it. And, like, you know, when this heirloom dates back to. So I love things like that. And mm-hmm. so I use Kitazawa. I use another company on the West Coast called Adaptive Seeds. And they're incredible. I got some of my peppers from them. They have very interesting varieties of chicories, escaroles, and radicchio, and onions. I got a lot of my my onions from them this year, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just thrilling. I'm excited about it all, you know?
Yeah. Have you tried turtle tree seeds?
I have. When I first started farming, I did do turtle tree seed.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. Those seeds really work.
Yeah, and they have a lot of Asian varieties as well, I found.
Yes, and I remember those seeds being very healthy. And I feel like those seeds from the turtle tree, you put them in the ground and they grow. And I feel like, I think that farm is managed by people that have Down syndrome.
Yeah, the Camp Hill community.
Yes.
work that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All, you know, and all based on Rudolf Steiner's agriculture. And yeah, good all around, you know, it's a whole package.
Oh,
so
definitely.
I like getting ham as well.
Yes, I do too. Yep. It's fun. Once you begin, you really go down the rabbit hole. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there. There's a woman on the North Fork called Stephanie Gaylor. She has a Salt of the Earth seed company. And she is growing heirlooms that do well on Long Island, on the East End. And she's amazing, knowledgeable person about, you know, heirloom varieties and open land race. And I can't even discuss it because I'll ruin it by talking about it. But the name of her farm is Invincible Summer Farm. And the name of her seed company is Salt of the Earth Seed Company. And she's local. And they have an excellent product as well.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I actually, you know, sounds like I'd like to interview her too, because I'm always interested in, you know, local people really starting something up that is regional, you know, as a little foodie. It's, you know, it's in my DNA as well. So right now your farm, you said, is 2 acres. Do you ever consider expanding, or do you like it small?
I like it small. For
yeah.
me, it's really thrilling to produce as much food as you can from a small area. And that just means for me continuing to build healthy soil, continuing to get more organized with my planting schedule, because I feel like I haven't maxed out productivity on my 2 acres. And, you know, so I can't imagine going any bigger, because 2 acres does occasionally feel like more than I can handle. So I think small is good for me.
And
you
do you
know?
Have helpers, or do you do it all on your own?
Oh, no. I have, thank God, I have amazing people that help me. I have, usually I have 2 full-time people and 2 part-time people from May through September. So, yeah, it's definitely takes a good crew to help keep everything healthy and happy and weeded and harvested and all of that.
Right. Just May to September, I find, you know, I get interns just like you started out. You know, I get summer interns here to help me, and they always have to go back to school the end of August or September, and then, you know, and then I'm on my own from September and October. And by the time October comes, you know, the thought of planting, you know, winter crops or cover crops, and, you know, it's hard.
Yes.
There,
you know, it's an amazing thing when you farm for a living, you start thinking about the fall in June, because really May. So usually I see pumpkins in May, plant them out in June. And if you don't get your fall crops in the ground by August 15th, you normally don't get a return on your investment, because we lose so much light. And, you know, so I always have that in my mind, August 15th. And so, you know, in July, I'm seeding cauliflower and broccoli and all the things that are all the fall crops. And so you really are thinking, because here in the Northeast, we have such a short window to make it happen. And one interesting thing I learned, every time I see daffodils, I think I have to plant parsnips, because I read once that that's when you plant parsnips, when the daffodils are blooming.
Uh-huh.
So it's amazing that, you know, the first signs of spring and you're already thinking about roasted parsnips and root vegetables, you know, but you do. You have to, every moment counts when you're farming for a living in the Northeast. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you use greenhouses to be able to start early and keep it going, right?
Oh, yeah.
How much of your land you have under greenhouses?
Not a lot. I have 1 30-foot-wide by 96-foot-long cold frame, so there's no heating element in it. And I have 1 18-by-50 greenhouse, which is heated. and a couple of other little coal frames, but not a lot. But oh my God, you can certainly get a huge amount of volume out of those areas. The unheated ones are amazing. So all winter long, I had kale and spinach and cilantro and scallions coming out of the cold frame. They're a cold tolerant crop winter long with zero heat input.
Uh-huh.
So the greenhouses really help, and people can do them in their backyards. I actually have these things called low tunnels, and it's a 10-foot piece of electrical conduit piping that you can bend into a U shape and throw some plastic over.
Yeah.
And so if you have raised beds in your backyard.
That's what I do. That's what I do for my raised beds. Exactly.
Yep. Exactly. Uh-huh. Then you never have to say goodbye.
Right.
You keep it going
right.
All winter long.
Right. That's what I do. Anyway, I can't believe it. We are just about out of time. So, Patty, just one last question. Can people come and visit you at the farm, or is it really just open to the CSA members?
If anybody ever wanted to, they could call me, or, well, actually, it's better to email me at earlygirlfarm@gmail.com.
Uh-huh.
And I love sharing the farm. I will never say no to a visitor because I believe this is something to be shared. So people could call me now. Unfortunately, the farm is currently closed to visitors until this virus passes us by. But when we're in the clear and we're in better days, I'm happy to share the farm and share my experience with people. I will never say no to that. So the best way to reach me is by emailing me at earlygirlfarm@gmail.com. And if I don't get back immediately, I will get back. And, you know, if anybody needs any resources, the things that I've talked about today with you, they shouldn't hesitate to send me an email and I'll share whatever information I have.
Thank you so much. And I will share your link, of course, on my website, too, so people can find it easily.
Great.
Thank you so much. And everybody who's been listening, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Vivani at ieatgreen.com. And I enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.